wonder if we could just take a deep breath and sit for a moment in praise and deep gratitude and appreciation. And I want to thank you. I want to thank you for our children. We're here because we're here to honor you. We appreciate you. We see you. We are grateful that you see us. We're grateful that you love us. And we're grateful that you're attempting to be a healing bridge at a very critical time in the history of the planet, this country, and our communities. And in the Buddhist tradition, I bow to you with deepest gratitude. And as I sat listening to you, I was moved by so much. And if you have questions, since the place is filled, and we will have questions afterwards, there are some little cards that got passed out earlier. Or if you have some paper, if you could just jot your question down while we do this, because we do want this to be interactive. But I was at a gathering in Oregon, actually, not too long ago, and an Asian American, Chinese American man, does a lot of healing work, shared something that just broke my heart. He said that he had gone to a gathering at a college or a university, and he asked, there's an exercise that he does in the same way that you do about race and racism. And he said he asked if the audience could give him 10 positive stereotypes of young African American men. And he said the audience was silent. And he said, 9? And there was silence. And finally kept going. And he said when he got down to about 3, somebody raised their hand and said, well, they're good athletes. Wow. And somebody else, 2. And I heard that and I went back to my room and I cried. Because it gave me insight into what it meant to walk in the skin of my then 17-year-old grandson. And so when you were saying that we are who we are because of how we see ourselves reflected, it was just a real insight into. And so I thought about that when I was reading the section of your book where you go into this prison with all these young and spirits and souls.
Wow. My work was with, my dissertation work was with African American males, 100 of whom were incarcerated and 100 that were not. But more importantly, very recently, I was walking in my community. I live in Stone Mountain, Georgia. And I was noticing, you know, as a group of young black males, and they probably high school age, you know, as one of them with pants so low, I just kept wanting to run and pull them down. I just was curious. You know what? But he couldn't catch me. You know, I can't think about run and pull them down, right? But I noticed how people were treating them. In other words, I saw them coming, and I watched people cross the street. And as they approached, I actually approached them. You know, so there's a whole crew of them. I said, hey, you, what do you plan to do with your life? And then the rest of them go, oh, man. I said, oh, no, I'm coming to you next. So I said, what are you planning? He said, I wanna own my own business. I said, okay, so what kind of business do you want? He said, well, my uncle, you know, he owns a barbershop, and he says if I go to, I said, well, that's great. How are you thinking about doing that? What are you doing in school? So he started engaging me. Then the other two were like, couldn't wait. They couldn't wait to tell me what their plans were. Now these same young men, when they see me, wait for me. Because you see, no one engages them. No one assumes that they have dreams and visions and skills and ideas. We walk across the street. These are my sons, you see. And again, I'm not going to be afraid of anybody who live in my neighborhood, you know. And I think that part of what's happening, that we can break so easily. This is not difficult for us to just reach out, you know. Say, how you doing? What? And you'd be surprised because they're excited that you're curious about them. They can't wait. Oh, I know, I can't wait till you ask me. Let me tell you what I'm doing. Let me tell you what I want to do. You know? And we have to engage. We have to become village again. Yes. We have to become community. You know, and I know that if we came this far with no help, really, nobody's going to tell me we don't have everything we need to move beyond this. I really believe, I wouldn't do the work if I didn't believe that, you know. But it means it's going to be a little bit more than the after-school program, okay? It's going to require more than that, you know.
That's really true. When you say that, several years ago I was on a bus in San Francisco and parked my car and then got on the bus. And when I got on, there was a young African-American, it was very crowded. There was a young African-American teenager sitting in the seats where disabled, what says, you know, mm-hmm. you should be disabled or senior. And there were seniors standing by, and there was a tense kind of racial moment because the people standing were white, and you could just feel the energy. Somebody, you know, sure. wanted him to get up. And it took me a while, but you can feel the tension was such that I turned around and I looked and there was this child sitting there. And so I had to make a decision because I was looking at people looking contemptuously at him and it's like, what do I say? What do I say? What do I do?
Right.
And when I could stand it no longer, I actually went over and said, you know, sweetheart, excuse me, there's some elders and seniors who want to sit down. And he said, oh, okay, thank you. You know, he just, he got right up. But I realized that what I went through, whereas my grandmother would not have waited that long. I had to go over, you know, I mean.
Yeah, exactly.
I grew up in a community where she would have just assumed this was her child.
That's right.
Gone straight, you know, and the child. So this whole thing of community and when you talked about reading slave narratives and interviewing elders, there is this intergenerational disconnect.
Yes. Yes. That's the other piece of the work is that, you know, is connecting people. And, you know, we've part of the system and part of it is structural. I mean, it's deliberate, you know, in some ways. For example, you know, I grew up and there would inevitably be teen parents, you know, no matter where you go. But they didn't raise the children. You know what I'm saying? You had Big Mama and Poppy and everybody who was there raising the child. But now laws are such that, you know, this child has to be in her own space and nobody else can live there. And, you know, and there are all these things that are divisive. And so now you literally have a 15-year-old raising somebody.
Right.
Right? And if she happened to be the child of a 15-year-old and grandma's 30 and getting her party on, there's no parenting that has happened. Right?
Right.
And then we're wondering why Johnny can't read. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
We aren't looking at the whole picture. We want just a snapshot. And you have teachers that go, well, I'm not a social worker. And, you know, all the, you know, what you've heard about what it's going to take. But we've never considered the injury. We never considered the impact of what this has had on us as a people and what we've come to believe and everything from what we eat to what we believe it means to be a man or a woman. All of those things have been tainted by some of the most horrific history of anybody. Mm-hmm. And again, can I just make a statement here?
Please.
You know, there are a lot of clinicians in the audience. I know because I met a few of them. And that's a wonderful thing. I'm so glad to see so many people of color that are engaging in this, because it's a shameful thing when people have mental health issues in our community. But those of you that know what post-traumatic stress disorder is, post-traumatic stress disorder is a disorder that occurs as a result of a single trauma. Single trauma. You don't even have to be there. You could just hear about the trauma and be diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. What we have to consider is looking at that one singular event. Now let's roll it back and say, we're not talking about one event, we're talking about a lifetime of trauma. So it's not plausible, and while we can't measure the post-traumatic, quote, stress disorder, it's not plausible that black people escaped without that diagnosis. Now, what are the symptoms? Think about this. Exaggerated startle response, outbursts of anger, feeling of foreshortened future. Now, start thinking about what has been folded in as cultural behavior. What you looking at? You start thinking about what is now adaptive social learning that has been transmitted, because I may not have been broken, but if my mama was broken, I didn't know her behavior was broken behavior. And there was nobody to come in and help treat us during slavery or after. And not only that, so let's look at it in terms of math, 246 years of trauma. And for those who really need to believe they're happy slaves, take them out of the equation. But those who weren't so happy, that were injured by seeing people beaten and raped and sold, okay, let's say now they didn't get treated, but they got freed. So 246 years of trauma, no intervention, no help, then you got freed. And then the trauma continued, didn't it? Jim Crow was after slavery. The whole Klan was after slavery. So now let's do the math. 246 years of trauma, no help, freed, no help, more trauma. We're amazing. Mm-hmm. We're amazing. So what we're looking at, what I'm saying is some of those behaviors are adaptive behaviors. I look at a lot of things that are going on. But the bottom line is we've got to do this work. I mean, whatever anybody else does, you know, God bless you, I'll keep doing it. But we certainly have to do it. We certainly have to show up for this. And I believe that this is not a individual heal. This is really a group heal. I think for this country to heal, we all have to get involved in this. Every single person, because all of us have been affected and infected by this thing. And, you know, we have to understand, we did not, those children of the 60s, we didn't pass the baton. We dropped it. And our children are letting us know that, you know, and that's across the board. But, you know, but again, it requires that everyone, it's not someone else's job. I'm telling you, my daddy used to say, bad news will beat you home. You know, in my neighborhood, everybody was involved and anyone could correct you. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So it was one of those things where it was, you know, folks looked out for each other. But now with the introduction of crack,
yes.
When we start looking at what just that single phenomenon did to our communities, what it ravaged in us, yes. And then we have to look at the introduction of those things into our community as well. But it's still doable, because remember, we have ancestors on whose shoulders we're standing that saw 100 years of slavery behind them and 100 in front of them, and still their joy came in the morning.
Yes.
So we can do this thing. We can do this thing.
And it's actually really important, just listening. Because as I was listening to you, I was just hearing my grandmother's voice, you know, and thinking about how the messages have changed a lot. Because I grew up with the grandmother who came from the South, and I think maybe had a fifth grade education. And because of the work cycle, and she was a girl. But she had absolute faith in me, loved me absolutely, unconditionally, and was clear, because I always had my head in a book, she created the space to make that all right, you know? And I remember that she used to always say, you have to be twice. Y'all know this,
yeah,
right?
Lord. Yes, Lord.
I grew up hearing, you have to be twice as good as white people. And I'm thinking, well, that ain't fair. You know, I mean, I come home and you complain about something that had happened in school, and you didn't quite have the language, you didn't of race, you didn't know it was race. It was just unfair. And it was so interesting because here was a relatively, quote, uneducated woman who was brilliant. Because she was saying, you know, I'm not, she didn't even go to whether it was right or right, wrong. It's like, this is the reality that you have inherited. This is your landscape. And so I thought she was being mean when she wouldn't listen to my complaint. And I'm sure it really broke her heart and hurt, but she was trying to have me understand something else, that this is just the reality of this landscape. And I decided that she really was not a very political woman. In the 60s, when we were all kind of like really militant, it's like, I just was just like, well, my poor grandmother, I can't bring my militant friends home to my grandmother, because she just is not clear. But she was really trying to have me understand, and all of my little friends understand, that we can, it is not fair, and I know you will change it, but that is not where you need to stop.
That's right, that's right.
And the belief is the belief in yourself. Exactly. Which, and so when you talked about the section about belief, I could see a lot of my friends just really kind of understanding that that kind of programming, that kind of conditioning, that kind of education by the village is really important.
And you know, again, I think that we are living in a global society. You know, we have to even look, you know, I look at where we're going, where the world is, and I'm sorry, we're a world now. And our children have been raised in a global conceptualization of reality. You know, you push a button and you can talk to folks in China. You can see them. You can engage them and interact. So we are moving into a whole nother level of how we define our humanity. And so I always tell people there are a couple of conversations we can have. And one of them is this one, you know, that I have to heal my people. I have to, you know, a really good friend of mine described it as an orchestra. And she says, you know, when you have an orchestra, you have a string section and you have, you know, percussion and you have, you know, all of these sections. And together they make a wonderful orchestra. And that's probably what you would call humanity. But sometimes the string section has to meet alone. And they've got to hone that skill alone. But not so that they are going to be alone, but so that they can go back to the orchestra and participate in it, you know?
Yeah.
Like I said, I have such great love and a great sense of belief and hope. The work is hard and it's tough, but it's so rewarding. It's so correct. And it's simple. You know, I was talking to some students, some graduate students today, and it was just really my honor to be with them, you know, to say that we are in these halls of education and they're very important. But what is really important is to be able to be with people. You know, it doesn't require, like you were saying, your grandmother and the wisdom that was on that brow, you know. She didn't need to go to school, but she was clear, and that knowledge was rich, and we need that knowledge. And that we somehow cannot, I used to ask when I was in my doctoral program, I would stop and raise my hand. I'm going, I'm confused. Are we talking about warm bodies still? Because it doesn't seem like we're talking about human beings anymore here. And I can't deal with that. I have to deal with the humanity part. And that's simple. That's what every single person can do. It doesn't require that you go and you become lettered. And becoming lettered is an important thing as well. But, you know, it doesn't matter. Everybody is part of the village, and we need them, you know. It made me think about some of the situations that have occurred in my community and some of the things that, you know, I've tried to teach, you know, in my own way. I'm in a Target or something, and I'm looking at two young women who are, they're screaming down the hall, and there's a little kid standing way in the back, just standing there. And what they're screaming is, you know, yeah, you just stay a little stupid behind there, little worse words, and you're standing there in your pee, just stand there in your piss, that's what you deserve. And I'm going, oh my goodness, you know what I'm thinking? I'm just trying to get a few groceries and things, you know? But, you know, those are things you just have to. So I walk over to them, and there's a young man standing there. They look like they're maybe 20, 18-ish. And there's a boy standing. He's about 10, and he's just wrenching his hands. He's just very nervous. So I walk over, and I said, oh, my goodness. Who's with this child? They said, oh, well, he don't belong to me, but I'm watching him. I said, okay. He wasn't two. All I know is he wasn't, whatever it was, he was not yet two. And here's this little toddler standing there in a puddle of urine. He doesn't even know what's going on, but he's terrified. And I said to her, I said, you know, this could hurt him so badly, what is going on right now, that it'll last for the rest of his life. And she goes, well, what am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? I said, well, you know, it's a couple of things. Little boys, they'll pee on themselves. They'll be 5, 6, 7, running, trying to get. I said, this is not uncommon. One. So you normalize it, right? It is not uncommon. I said, and maybe you have to say to them, little man, we're not going to drink anything before we do this, and let's go potty first. I said, there's a lot of things. And at which point, the little 10-year-old takes off and runs and grabs him, going, I got you, buddy. I got you, little buddy. He was looking for permission to go get him, right? And then I realized there's two things going on. They're not bad people. They were humiliated and didn't know what to do. So I wasn't going to humiliate them as well, you see? So I'm taking care of both groups of people here. And so I'm saying, you know what? They said, thank you, ma'am. I didn't know. I said, that's okay. You know, I said, I'm a mother. I'm a grandmother. I said, you know, you can't, sometimes we just don't know. Thank you, ma'am. Thank you. You know, but those are moments when we can't shake our heads and go, that's just a shame. Because there used to be elders who would be there with them. Do you know what I'm saying? Guiding them. So we have to do it. Now, they might cuss you out. Don't get me wrong. You can get cussed out. That can happen too, but you know.
That's true. That's what I went through with the young man on the bus, that, you know, he might just come at me, but then I have to take that risk.
Right.
You know, part of what I really love about your work and it's kind of epitomized in the book is that you end on healing. And, you know, Karim mentioned earlier about growing a global heart, which actually began as we stood at the door of no return, my husband and I. And after I, having been in the women's dungeon, gone up the same stairs that you went up, and I think the thing that I was most devastated by was that when the young woman went up the stairs, she was going to see the governor, and that all of the women had to clean her up and send her up those stairs. And when she came back down, all of the men and soldiers who were on duty had the privilege of raping her. And I was so devastated, I think I cried for 2 or 3 days. And, you know, as I always say, you know, my husband, who clearly loves me, after, you know, 2 or 3 days said, you know, what would healing look like? And that was a really profound question, because I was not ready to hear about healing. I was really kind of needed to be. Yeah. I mean, I just was curled up in a ball. But, you know, the question of healing and what would that look like? And it was then that the idea of planting, because he said, what is most hurtful about this? And I said, what was most hurtful was standing at that door and knowing that millions of people, aunts and uncles and mothers and fathers and nieces and nephews and grandmothers, and we didn't know their name, that they were just totally erased. And it was then that we decided to work with environmentalists there to plant the million trees along the transatlantic slave route and another million trees along the Underground Railroad. And we actually planted the first 100 trees in Selma at the 46th anniversary of the Dr. King's march to Montgomery. And I mention that because of the elders who were there, these women from the civil rights movement, you know, Annie Pearl Avery, and hearing their stories, and Janet Moses, and, you know, many of the women who were in this book, Jean Wiley. Jean Wiley, would you please stand? I would be remiss if we did not, in terms of asking you. Jean Wiley is in this book, Hands on the Freedom Plow, Personal Stories by the Women of SNCC. And to have the opportunity to have a group of young women in Selma sit with people like Jean, who talked about completing Dr. King's march, that he didn't complete the march, but Jean Wiley took some of her students from Tuskegee and marched. And so it's really honoring this rich tradition. So part of what I love about your work is the healing, the focus on the elders, and really just celebrating our resilience.
I'm reminded of what has motivated me so much. There's an incident that occurred when I decided to write the book. I kind of had to step off from the university. I had to figure out how I was going to support myself. So it was huge for me to, because there was nothing to step off on. Okay, so financially, it was one of those things where I didn't know where it was, but I knew I had to write the book. But I was a little scared. I could hear my mother who passed away saying, "Girl, that's a good job. What you do? keep the good job. You got benefits, you know." I struggled with that, and I was at the University of Chicago. And I had just finished talking about what I wanted to write. And there was a woman, an old woman at the back of the room, and it was an auditorium where it was on a slant. And she she was really old. Blue black people know what that is, blue black, and had that little blue haze around the eyes. Okay, so really old, really gnarled knuckles, and she's on a walker, trying to walk down to me, and I stop her. I said, "No, please don't, I will come to you." So I came down off the stage, and there were two younger, looked like great-great-grands. They were so, just really, really so appropriate and loving and honoring her and respectful. And they were kept trying to help her, but she wouldn't let them. And so finally, I stood there, and she was laboring to breathe. She was like, so I waited, and I waited for her to rest. And finally, she took her hands off the walker, and she reached out to me. And I put my hands in hers, and she covered my hands. And she leaned in, and she just smiled at me a good long time. And then she said, "You know, I have waited for you my whole life. Now I can die." That's what she said. And I said, "What does she see?" But there was something she saw, and she simply turned. That was all she said, and walked away.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that story. And Monique, I think what we're going to do now is open it up. Do you have some questions?
Hi, everyone. We're not going to be able to get to all the questions, and I apologize. But I tried to kind of pare it down. Number one, Joy, Dr. Joy, folks just wanted to say thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
So they said, "Come back to New Orleans. We miss you. We love you." And the questions kind of pared down into four categories, so I'm going to do some working with it. The first one: what is the single most important thing both African Americans and whites can do to heal themselves from PTSS?
Tell the truth. I mean, the first thing that strikes me is to tell the truth. You know, tell the truth to yourself, to your families. You know, I think that's where the rubber meets the road, is when we're willing to be unpopular. And this work sometimes will make you unpopular, but it's truth. So that's my answer to that. We have to start having the courage to tell the truth and to do that together, because trust me, you know, we have lots of allies and family that aren't black in this work. Mm-hmm. This is all of our work, yeah.
Thank
and
you.
In fact, some people who aren't black do better work than some of the folks that are black and injured, because you all know a number of black people who aren't black, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'll say no more about that.
So the next part of that is, what are strategies for healing from PTSS?
Okay, let me, will this work from here? Yeah, it will work. All right, I'm gonna move forward. Basically, some of this stuff, I do a whole lot around, let's see, where is it? No, that's,
I do a lot of stuff. I'm trying to get to the... Okay, so that's the, or this is, I believe in a virtual village. We need to build a virtual village. We don't live in villages, but we can create village. Now let me explain what I mean by that, because this really does work. I have a village. My village is broad, it's diverse, it includes people from every walk of life all over the world. There are people that aren't my family, clearly, that are in my village, and there are people that are in my family that aren't in my village. Okay, I had to make that call. Now, when they get healthy, you can come on in, but you can't bring crazy with you, okay? So, in my village, I have, you know, notice that's my chart. I have my parents have both passed away, but I have people who represent parent for me that help me, that I go and spend time with, that advise me, and I have everyone, you know, to fit into each one of those categories. So in my study guide, I kind of help people figure out who are the people in your life. Because for some folks, when they saw this list, they went, well, I got is Pookie, right? And God bless him, Pookie can't do all this. So what that means though, is that sometimes I am parent in someone else's village. Do you see? We begin to say, I said, well, you know, I can help you with some of these folks, because these are the folks that help inform my life, that keep me healthy as a person, you know, that are able to take care of me when I can't take care of myself. So I really do believe that that's part of what we have to do, is we have to help people by plugging ourselves in and finding these people in our lives and reaching out to other people to figure out if they can help you with it. That's village, since we don't live in those villages. And when I say I'm serious about this, these are the people that inform what I do, that say, I want some more eyes on this, because I don't know that I'm detached enough to be able to figure out what's going on here. So I need some help. And there are people in every one of these categories. And then, of course, in the book, you know, what I did was I took these and I stretched them out. And I think that's the last one, isn't it? No, there it is. So these are, you know, some of the steps to healing. And the steps of healing, this is simplified, but in the study guide, I kind of really elaborate on them. You know, that part of the whole idea, of course, number one is to tell the truth, but to know yourself, and not only our history, but your own personal history. We're not telling the stories to our children. You know, so they don't know who they are. They don't know who grandpa was. They don't know who directly paid for them to be here. And we need to begin to help, and sometimes you get real creative with folks who don't want to talk about stuff. You know, I have all kind of tricks to get people to talk about themselves, because our children need to know who those folks are as best we can. So not only to know your broader history, you know, Harriet Tubman, I need to know about Ophelia, you know, my grandmother, who all I can remember from Ophelia, she says, you come from smart people. Yes, smart. She used to say that all the time. I think I believe that. So we have to preserve those memories. Look beyond healing, seek to be healthy. So it's not, this is an ongoing process in every aspect of your life. You know, we understand that in terms of health disparities, we are at the tip top, black folks are, and black women are at the tip top of that. So we are dying at alarming rates. A wonderful study just came out. It's called Myself, My Womb, or My Womb, The Self. You know, and it's Time Magazine, October 2010. And what they're saying now is that much of heart disease, obesity, hypertension, cancer, all of these are attributable to the 9 months in the womb. So we're looking at the condition that that women are in, the level of stress, cortisol, all of those things impacting us. So when I say seek to be healthy, we have to begin to look at all of those things that are, and they'll call those micro, you know, what do they call a micro oppression? Aggression. Aggression. Well, I don't know the word. All I know is that it's stress. And what it is that we've never measured what that feels like to constantly live in the skin and to constantly be feeling that chipping away. It affects our health. Build esteem, healthy and accurate. I always use that measure and not high and low, which is what we've been taught. High self-esteem is good, low self-esteem is bad. How many of you have met people with high self-esteem that are, well, recto openings? Okay, that your ego gets in the room 10 days before them, and you gotta go to meetings with them, right? They got plenty of high self-esteem going on there. That's not healthy, though. So I look at self-esteem from, and when a person thinks too much of themselves, it's inaccurate, just as a person who thinks too little of themselves. It's an issue of accuracy, not of high or low. So we want an accurate assessment, which means that you do need to contribute something. You do need to do something. Right, so we start talking about efficacy there. Control your inner world, manage stress and conflict. We are modeling very often for our children how to deal with things, and very often we don't talk about anything. Everything we implode or explode. So you have to understand, how do your children figure out how to problem solve at school, at work, interacting in different environments? They're looking at us, so we have to learn how to manage that stuff. You know, and how to manage the issue of anger, which is something that we really need to take a look at, because we got a reason to be angry, but it'll destroy if we don't get a hold of it. The other thing is racial socialization. This is deliberate. It's a resiliency factor. I use it as a measure in my research empirically. What I was able to identify is that our children are much healthier when we racially socialize, which is what your grandmother did. Mm-hmm. That's what your grandmother did when she sat you down and said, let me tell you what time it is for the day you're living in. Now, that means that, baby, you could be anything you want to be. You know, you could, don't you worry about it. You just try hard. But just in case you run up on a damn fool, here's what you do. Mm-hmm. You don't just send them out there in a racially charged battlefield with nothing. You go, yeah, but just in case. You need to back somebody up. Let me tell you what you got here. And that means that you begin to explain to them, you know, who you are. You're not a descendant of enslaved people. You're the descendant of captured free people. You know, you come from richness. You got mama and big mama. And if you can't get a hold of me, but we got you. And you got a God. You know, so you racially, deliberately socialize them instead of this we are the world concept. And then they get caught in it and get angry, you know. So build upon strength, past and current. Obviously, we're resilient. We got this far. And model the health. Be the healing that you seek. We can't tell. You know, one of the things that when I was talking to the hip-hop community, you know, and part of the issue is they said, you know what, y'all dropped the ball. We did the best we could. And the only time we hear from you is when we've done something wrong. You know, why is it you can't appreciate anything good we do? Again, looking at those qualities that in black males or in black youth. If we are constantly looking for the wrong thing, of course I wouldn't want to be around you either. And look in the mirror and understand that this is a never-ending thing. So the study guide actually presses that. That's a long way to answer that question. But it's really a collective effort and it's an individual effort. You can't have one without the other. You have to be doing your personal work as well as trying to work with other people.
Mm. Thank you.
Okay.
Yes.
Woo!
Okay. Yes.
Woo!
So you brought up the concept of self-esteem, and in your book you talk about vacant self-esteem. Can you speak to that a little bit? Because what I find when I try to teach it or talk about it, it often gets pathologized. Oh, wait, you're saying brown folks have no self-esteem? What? And then I'm stuck in that space.
Yes, I know. You know, one of the things that I also try very hard to do, you know, because that was always the dilemma. Several people of my mentors were very concerned. They said, well, Joy, what is this going to do to black people? They were very concerned about what the book would do, whether it would feel people would feel inspired or whether they would want to burn things down. We weren't certain for a while, but it turned out that folks were inspired. You know, that folks did feel good. The notion of a vacant esteem, and I try to describe that in the book. And my son, who is here, Nadim, who's out there, who's an assistant, who's working with me, who's part of my business, was really front and center to this notion of vacant esteem, which I connect very much to the issue of respect. And what I did when I was looking at these African-American male youth, I was trying to figure out why they were violent. And I was trying to figure out what was causing it. And there were a couple of things that came out in the research that was interesting. They were saying that the absence of mother was more likely to be a cause of violence than the absence of father. Meaning that even if the mother was present but was emotionally absent, that young man was more harmed by that than the absence of his father. So it spoke a lot to women. And the role that people have diminished around the idea of, raising sons. They really do. That the position of mother is very critical. The other thing that I realized is that when you start looking at what happened to my son. So what happened was I had just gotten back from South Africa. My son, Nadim, who was young, he gets very embarrassed about this. But anyway, grown man, strong. He was a kid. And he was, I came outside because my daughter had said to me that, you know, there's a boy that was going to beat up my son and also pee on the car. So I had to go outside. So I'm outside and there's these cruel little boys. Nobody's over 10. Everybody looking tough. Right, and my son is trying to look tough, but you know he was a little scared. So I walked into the group of them, and there was the one little boy that was pretty prominent, clearly the leader. And I said, "Excuse me, has my son done something that, you know, I need to know about?" He goes, "Yeah, I want to know if he got some kind of eyeball problem." I said, "What did you say?" He said, "I want to know if he got some kind of eyeball problem. What he staring at?" And I said, wait a minute. Are you saying to me you want to beat up my son because he was looking at you? He could have been looking at you because, you know, maybe he thought you want to play a little one-on-one. There's a little, little basketball thing here. Maybe look down the street. There's a little, park down the street. Maybe he was looking at you because maybe he wanted you to go play a little Nintendo game, huh? So all the little kids are looking at me like, whoa, lady. It got fully therapeutic on them, you know. So what happens is, you know, I start telling them about how we can't, you know, fight in the community. Sometimes we hear sirens and gunshots and we got to stop that. We got to work together. My whole little spiel. But then I realized something right in that moment. I remembered Africa saying, "I see you." And African Americans saying, "What you looking at?" What could have happened to a 10-year-old boy that he could not withstand a gaze? What did he perceive? You know, it wasn't in a white kid's eyes. It was in a black kid's eyes. He did not like the reflection in the mirror. He did not like what he saw reflected back at him. And he didn't like it so much he was ready to beat my son bloody for it. That's vacant esteem. And so what I realized about that is it's an interesting thing, because according to our history, if you look at our history, of who we are, oral traditions, all the things that you feel from me, which is, by the way, symbolic imagery is what I'm using to talk to you. I'm intertwining stories, which is very much our culture. But there's a statement that says that the black man is like the pupil of the eye, surrounded by a sea of white, but it is the pupil that contains the sight. It beholds what is before it. We are a people of vision. Now, when I looked at the fundamental principle of respect, which is what I discovered was a greater determinant, one of the major determinants of violence, is perceived disrespect. I then looked at what respect meant. And respect actually doesn't mean what most people think. It comes from the Latin. Spect is spectacle, respect, look again. That's what respect means. Look again. That means look at me again. Don't look at me the way everyone has told you to look at me. Look again. Give me a chance and maybe you'll see me. And that's what that little boy wants. And that's what every little black boy wants, is for you to look again. And with those other eyes that say that you see in me what's in you. And that's what I learned about vacant esteem. It's basically a fundamental of learning how there's something worthy to love in there. And they can't do it because they have to be, you know. So all that is just posturing. But deep down, that's what we're talking about. That's what I meant by vacant esteem, not a pathology.
Thank you. So this question says, struggle manifests character. Struggles manifest character raised as black in America. Now I am tough and should not anything upset me, not even being raised black in America, or is my toughness not enough? And I just wanted to give voice to this question. Is this question not enough? Is this toughness not enough?
You know, when I look at black people, when I say we're amazing, we really are salt of the earth. Saw the earth. And, you know, again, a lot of the fear that white people have had about black people, you know, the whole idea that we're going to turn on every, we would have done that a long time ago. But it's not who we are. it really isn't who we are. It's not, you know. And our toughness can only be matched by our spirit. You know, there is just something, you know, you think about how black people talk. We go, hey, I feel you. I'm not feeling that, right? You start thinking about, even back in my day when they said, man, the vibe was so thick you could cut it with a knife, right? The vibration. We walk in, we could feel. And you see that intuitive part. And I think all people have been given certain gifts, certain abilities. And it is that vision, it is that heart, and it is, to some degree, that fortitude, that toughness. But the toughness is not what people think. It's not aggression. It's not violent. It's not anger. It's really certitude, you know, being still, you know. And again, like, you know, Maya Angelou says, still I rise. You know, despite it all, you know, still I rise. Because it's that quiet knowing that we have to have, but our children are missing it. They're missing it because we're not transmitting it anymore. And that means, you know, you get them in a room. I've been saying to people for a long time, I want a room like this, but I want the young people. We need to hear them. We need to speak to them. And they respond, you know, but we got to love them back. We got to love them back.
So I know we need to close, but I just want to acknowledge two things. There's questions I didn't get to, and they're focused mainly around teaching, being teacher. And being therapists, being therapists of color, working clients of color, dealing with this, and being white therapists working with clients of color, dealing with this, and teachers, white teachers are predominantly teaching our black children how to deal with that, and the use of the N-word in the school system. Now, I'm sorry I can't get to everybody, but I just wanted to give voice to it, if you can say two sentences. And
well, you know, actually, those are actually full-on workshops that I do, right? Because
we were going to have to invite you back.
Yeah, I began in the classroom. That's what I worked in.
So you have to come back.
I don't think what I have there. I was trying to see if I have a slide. It would be too much for me to do, but yeah, I certainly. And there's very specific things, very, very specific, a model, a number of things. So
what that means is clearly we will have to have you back. And we'll try and have you back for a whole week.
Wow.
We are affirming that we will afford that.
Well, you know, if you take me fishing.
Yeah. Okay.
It'll defray the cost because I love to go fishing.
Oh, okay.
It's my favorite thing.
I just really want to say that this is the culminating. I mean, it's just... What a life to begin with Cornel West, and for those of you, and that this to be the culminating conversation that we're having has been one of the highlights of my. And so I want to say thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you all. We do have a workshop tomorrow, but it's a very small and. The space is very limited. There might be, if you want to speak to somebody in public programs, but I just want to say thank you for showing up, for being here, and thank you for just this healing that's already begun. Thank you all.